leaders.
We pose the problem to human beings in their relations with the world.
Change.
GP made this one right here. You know it's a hit.
Impact.
Liberation is a praxis of action to reflection upon the world.
Welcome to the pedagogy
Justice.
Of the obsessed.
Hello, and welcome to today's edition of Pedagogy of the Obsessed. My name is Cynthia Rosario, former elementary school principal turned graduate student. On today's segment, we will focus on one of my obsessions, the connection between social-emotional learning and culturally relevant pedagogy. In my own work as a 23-year veteran educator and school leader, I have witnessed well-intentioned educators across the country subscribe to the notion of our nation's cultural mosaic, but they explicitly dilute or overlook students' cultural capital. Students are left to shed their identities at the doorstep before entering school. I can remember as a Spanish-speaking kindergartner entering a traditional public school where most students were proficient English speakers. My parents were demeaned for their heavy accents, and they insisted I learn English as quickly as possible so as not to face the discrimination they encountered when they arrived in the Bronx. The message was clear as soon as we entered school. Your culture is not valued here. As a teacher, my colleagues and I decided to be intentional about honoring the culture, language, and social capital our students brought into school. I witnessed the transformative power of culturally relevant teaching practices. Students were more plugged into lessons, attendance improved, families were excited about learning alongside their children, and ultimately, students fared better academically. As a school leader, I drew upon the seminal work of Gloria Ladson Billings on culturally relevant pedagogy, as she invites educators to focus on three areas: affirming students' cultural identity, providing students with the tools to achieve academic proficiency, and developing critical perspectives to challenge inequities. Those who subscribe to her work often omit the latter requirement of challenging inequities, which in my perspective is the most important, as it leads to liberation. And it becomes increasingly important in today's racialized political environment. As part of my recent coursework, I found myself in a number of K-12 schools. With the exception of one school, each building felt as sterile and nondescript as the next. They felt very much like entering a strip mall in a suburban neighborhood. We can be anywhere in the country and they all look the same. These schools, like strip malls, wanted for cultural flavor, salsa, if you will. It made me question whether or not this really matters. Or is it just a personal preference that happened to work in my small corner of the education world? With us today to dig deeper are four education leaders who can offer insight into the value of embedding culturally relevant pedagogy as part of educating the whole child. Rosa Rivera McCutcheon, who has been an associate professor in the graduate leadership program at Lehman College of the City of New York in the Bronx for the past 8 years, Jamal Bowman, founding principal of the Cornerstone Academy of Social Action Middle School in the Bronx. He has been the leader for the past 9 years. We also have David Rosas, elementary school director at the Hacketti Community Charter School in the Bronx. And finally, Christy Cuellar Lescano, founding instructional specialist also at Hacketti Community Charter School. We have a heavy Bronx contingent with us today.
Why does culturally relevant pedagogy even matter? And what would you say to naysayers to convince them that this feel-good stuff does actually lead to student agency and achievement?
Are there still non-believers? Mm-hmm. Do they exist? Well, first of all, it is feel-good stuff. Again, this is about emotional engagement. We want students to feel good about the learning environment in which they are in, right? The second thing is, how are we defining student achievement? So there are some schools that look at that just through the lens of a standardized test score. There are many other schools that are taking an interdisciplinary project-based approach, and in alignment with that approach, they're aligning it to sort of humanistic pedagogy and methodology, as well as culturally relevant pedagogy, right? So I think, first, how are we defining achievement? And then second, yes, you know, it is feel good. It's okay to feel good and be passionate and be excited about your learning environment, because that also aligns to high self-esteem and self-worth and self-concept, right? And the better you feel about yourself, the stronger you are in terms of mental health, and the stronger your achievement will be in a more holistic sense.
So I would say, I like that Jamal kind of jumped in and reaffirmed the idea that there is this feel-good component and that there's nothing wrong with that, that school should not always feel like it's work, that it should be something that you want to engage in. And certainly as someone who has three children kind of working their way through the system, I always am keen to observe at what point their interest in schooling kind of drops off, because it begins to feel less like a fun learning environment to one that feels just like work. And so I would also say that in, you know, almost 20 years, I think, of researching and working in schools, what I've come to really understand is that kids really need to feel cared for. They need to feel emotionally safe, and that's when the learning starts to happen, right? Because we can only begin to take risks and risk failure so that you can learn. And you can only do that when you feel safe, when you feel emotionally safe, when you feel cared for. But I do want to also kind of cycle back and focus on this idea of the fluff, which was, you know, the feel-good fluff, right? And so while we do want to really underscore the importance that feel-good is important in schooling, I don't want to discount the fact that in far too many places, when they try to do the work of socio-emotional learning, culturally responsive practice, they fall into the trap of just doing the fluff, right? And so there's an important acknowledgement and recognition and constant work around making sure that when you're doing this work, particularly in historically marginalized communities, that you are paying attention to also ensuring that that students are being prepared to the best of their ability, that the expectations are still there for students, expectations and beliefs that students can achieve, you know, pretty much anything. And I don't want to lose that, because I think that too often schools focus a lot on only one side of this equation, and that's ultimately to the student's detriment, right? And so that's really critical. And I think that it happens too much, right? That kids go to school and they feel cared for, and they feel, you know, they talk about school as family, but then they also can't, you know, succeed in college, right? Because they're not able to do the academic work. And so that's important.
Yeah, that's a really important point that I just want to jump in really quick and really quickly underscore, because high expectations is also social emotional learning. Right? I mean, rigor is embedded throughout all of that. You can challenge students really hard to the threshold of their learning and push them and love them to death, and they will both achieve and feel loved. And that's critical, and that's something that I've learned throughout my career as an educator, and especially during my time as a principal.
We're talking about children's lives. We're talking about children's identities, children's communities and families. And so this is all important work that is at the foundation of a child's education. And so if we're to assume that a child's going to learn any content or any new ideas, we also have to work with the child's realities and backgrounds and make sure that that's at the foundation of any new learning.
And I, again, kind of going back to that idea of connecting what they already bring. And so as a teacher, you're always trying to make learning meaningful. And connecting it to their own personal lives is the a most connected way to do that.
Yes, and thank you for that, because intentionality matters, right? And so in your school, Jamal, at CASA, how does this work live in the day-to-day? Is it a framework? Is it a program? What does it look like at your school?
First and foremost, we love our kids. We love our community, and we treat them as we would treat our own children. So because of that, we challenge them academically and socially in the same way that we would challenge our own children. So just philosophically and, I guess, emotionally, that's what we bring to the table. In addition to that, we ensure that, you know, the authors that students are reading are culturally representative of who they are. That's very important, from Malcolm X, Toni Morrison, to many others. In addition to that, we implement, you know, what I guess some call hip-hop pedagogy, which is not just about hip-hop culture. I mean, it is rooted in that, and students can relate to that and connect with that, but it's also rooted in creativity and innovation. So not just about acquiring knowledge about yourself and acquiring knowledge about the world around you, but how do you apply that knowledge in an innovative way to create a new, you know, program or system or idea or something that can serve not just yourself but your community. So we're a social action school, so everything we do, we try to embed in sort of community empowerment and upliftment. You know, that's our approach.
And Rosa, can you discuss examples besides CASA where you've seen this work done well?
So my research, well, yes, and certainly I see it a lot at CASA whenever I go there. And I would say that even in those pockets, just to kind of close out that conversation with respect to CASA, is that even in those pockets, with those individual teachers that I have seen that don't necessarily model what Jamal is talking about, what you have is the presence of leadership and culture in a school such that, you know, that little slice either toes the line really quickly or finds another place to be. So that's an important part, and I think we'll talk about that in a little bit. But my research is primarily in middle and high school, and sadly what I would say is that I actually don't see it enough. And I think that there are a number of reasons for that. One relates to this idea of, you know, school being fun versus school being work, as if those two things have to be kind of diametrically opposed. And so what ends up happening is that pretty much, from my experience, pretty much, you know, kind of midway through elementary school, that joy disappears, or it starts to dissipate at least. And so by the time I start going into schools and looking at what's happening, there's a lot of things that are happening at the school, in particular, especially because of the community. So working in the Bronx, which in terms of community resources and access and opportunity is already starved, right? Because we're talking about institutional, systemic, and historical racism and classism. And so when kids are getting into middle school and high school, they are really, really behind, particularly in high school. And so that's when the crunch begins to be felt and then responded to. And so I don't see enough of it in the schools where I do research, but there are pockets.
And so, David, can you talk a little bit about, is there a specific program, a social-emotional learning program that you're using at Hachette? And is culturally relevant pedagogy embedded within that program, or does it live somewhere else?
At Hachette, we're using the Second Step program to guide conversation. It's more of a resource for teachers. It's not necessarily a script that we follow. I would say the script that we have to follow comes from the daily situations that come up with children in the classroom, in the school. And so it's really about the teachers being flexible and resting on culturally relevant teaching and pedagogy in order to inform the next steps. So I would also say that CRP is embedded within our curriculum design. It's embedded within our professional growth and training here at Hachette. And it's just an idea that we all come back to. It's a big rock that's at the foundation of our work at Hachette.
Often this work is done well in middle and high schools, sometimes not so much in elementary schools. Christy, can you talk a little bit about what examples look like in an elementary classroom?
I'm thinking about three ways that we kind of do that in the elementary. As we are planning our new modules, taking a look at how do we bring in what kids already know into each module. So for example, in second grade, across the city, there's always a module that has them explore New York City then and now and has them really anchor into what the city looked like before and what it looks like now. At Hecate last year, because this particular community in the Bronx is experiencing gentrification, the kids and the teachers explored how the Bronx and Mott Haven in particular is experiencing change. They went home and were able to interview parents and neighbors and really see how is that the changes that are currently happening are affecting them and then what that might look like in the future. How will that change their neighborhood? In kindergarten, just yesterday, they were planning their new module that has them exploring schools and the purpose of schools and why do kids come to school. And for some of them, they have strong connections to two events that just happened, looking at a school that got destroyed in Mexico during the earthquake and schools that really got obliterated in Puerto Rico. So thinking about how do we have kids connect to, well, what does schooling look like in those places and why would schools matter? Mm-hmm. And how does that impact how we look at schools here?
Mm-hmm. Jamal, can you talk a little bit about what evidence you have that demonstrates that this type of work does ultimately benefit children?
I guess based on how schools are currently measured as being successful, in 2012, we ranked in the top 17% of middle schools throughout the city in terms of achievement and growth. A couple of years after the Common Core standards were implemented, in 2015, we had the number one combined growth score average in the city. In 2016, we were top five in our district, maybe actually top one or two in both reading and math achievement, and we still occupy a top five position in math achievement. Again, underscore what Rosie mentioned earlier, it's not just about the culturally relevant curriculum or social-emotional learning. Those are two big pillars of it. It's also about, for lack of a better term, college and career readiness standards and academic rigor being implemented in all classrooms, pushing our kids to be their academic best, being strategic in terms of scheduling so that they have more time on tasks, so that class sizes are lowered, so that we have tutoring both during the day and after school. So, you know, you can't have one without the other. You can't have the culturally relevant piece without the academic excellence piece. And investing in quality teaching and teacher training and professional development and doing the work around curriculum to ensure that we're preparing kids for high school if they leave us. So I just want to definitely underscore that point again.
So David, what evidence do you have in your work that shows the benefits of this?
Yeah.
Is there data that we can point to?
Yeah. I like this question because it also gives us an opportunity to broaden the definition of data, right? And so many times data, we think of spreadsheets, percentages, statistics, right? I think the data that I would draw on to answer this question is what we see day in, day out in terms of the children's realities, behaviors, choices, words. We have many kids who have developed agency in speaking up for themselves here at Hecate, speaking up for their friends, speaking up for their communities and their families. And so we have children who are claiming their space. We have children who are proud of what they represent. We have children taking on leadership roles and teaching other folks, adults included, as to who they are, what does it mean to achieve academically, socially, and emotionally. I would also throw in culturally what it means to achieve, right? And we have children who are able to start critically thinking about what's going on in our neighborhood and our community. Why is it that it takes, for example, an ambulance or police officers an hour and 30 minutes, 2 hours to get to our school when we need help? But in other parts of the city, it takes less than 3 minutes, right? So those are questions that children are starting to wrestle with. And so I think that's the data to show that culturally relevant pedagogy, thinking, curricular design is essential and necessary. Again, we're talking about kids' lives and realities. This work only enhances what the kids already own and do.
I don't have any specific data points. point, other than looking at national trends, think about reframing the idea of achievement gap as a debt, as Gloria Ladson Billings has said, or if we think about it as opportunity gaps and not as placing the blame solely on the individuals or at all on the individuals who are not performing well on these high-stakes exams or on the kind of traditional achievement measures.
If we wanted to see this idea spread across every school, every classroom in our nation, what is it going to take? Is it traditional leadership prep programs? Is it using the political will? You know, what context is relevant at this time for us to remove those barriers and see this as an opportunity to scale?
I would say, first and foremost, scholars of color that I work with who have really put forth, you know, just a very simple idea, which is that schools are organized to do exactly what they were intended to do. The conversations we have about trying to figure out, you know, why aren't schools achieving, helping kids achieve what, you know, what they need to achieve? Why are these gaps persisting? There is this argument that can be made if we just kind of look at the history of schooling in the United States with respect to certainly kind of blacks and whites, and then kind of you add in the other historically marginalized group, indigenous people, immigrants, English language learners, special education. Given the fact that these gaps have persisted and schools seem to be organized in ways that are really just detrimental in every sense of that word for historically marginalized community, then it really leads you to a very simple conclusion, which is that schools are doing exactly what they were intended to do, that there is no question that people are kind of wringing their hands over in terms of trying to understand how to do this better, what are we doing with scaling. In fact, schools are doing what they're intended to do. So let's maybe start there and then work our way from there. In terms of thinking about what needs to happen, what are the conditions that need to exist in order for this work, I may be jumping the gun, but in terms of the teacher and leadership preparation program, because I think of that as an important condition, you almost have to figure out, where do I intervene here? To begin thinking about the conditions, well, we need to think about, well, how are the folks that are going into the schools prepared to do this kind of work or not prepared to do this kind of work? And that's really critical, right? Because if you don't have a leader who has been trained or even touched on these ideas in their own preparation, how will they be fit to lead their school communities? Really thinking back even to the teacher training pieces and to the leadership training pieces, I think those are really important conditions that need to be met within the school. And then around and outside of the school, you know, we have to understand that schools are not, you know, these kind of monoliths that are not impacted or do not impact the communities that surround them. We really need to widen the lens and try to understand, well, what is it that communities need in order for kids and parents and grandparents and anyone that's involved in the school to have the opportunity to be actively engaged and thriving in a learning community. I think those are some of the basic conditions that need to be met.
I think what she articulates really displays the heavy lift involved in what needs to happen. But you mentioned the term, Cynthia, political will, and I want to focus on that because a lot of these decisions regarding teacher preparation, principal preparation, school funding, curriculum testing, all come about as a result of policy that is, you know, written, adopted, and enacted by elected officials. And in many cases, those elected officials have been compromised by their positions of power and by financial influences that are too involved in our political process. So they're not thinking as much about the people that they serve and about the children in our schools. They're thinking more about maintaining their political position, their position of power. So I think it's political will.
In terms of the barriers, we were looking just last week at this framework of how to make sure that we're teaching for social justice. One of the things that stood out for me in looking at that new framework, where I feel like we still need to do work, even within our community, with our parents, with board members, with community members, is that not only are you providing access to kids so that they achieve, but that that's not the only thing. And so those two factors, it teaches them how to play into the system. But then the other two parts of that framework we were looking at is really having kids solidify their identity and see power in their identity and their voice so that not only do they can they play the game, but then they can change the game once they're in it. I thought that was a framework to me that struck a chord, because I think for a lot of parents even, they say, no, no, just teach them so that they can pass the test and they can achieve and do well in the society, and don't see the value of that identity and that power that they must also have when they exit school so that they can then make changes.
I think another barrier in the past 10, 20 years, starting with NCLB, is this obsession with data as measured by percentages, statistics coming from standardized tests. If we take a deep dive into what standardized testing is really looking at, I think we'll find that there is more that make marginalization of communities such as ours. So we've got children of color, we've got children coming from lower income backgrounds. The barrier is we're not recognizing the holistic picture that children, families, and communities are offering. And we're only focusing on a snapshot that's collected across 2 to 3 days, right? I think in order to move past that, we ourselves as educators have to critically analyze what bureaucracy is standardized testing servicing, and how do we start to move testing so that it services children, right? If we want to figure out how well schools do, let's figure out some other measures. But let's not put children in the crossfire here when we're analyzing and we're collecting this information. So I think to bring this to scale to every classroom, it's just empowering teachers, educators to be a bit more critical and to be brave and name what are the systems that are getting in the way of a holistic approach to teaching and learning.
Thank you to our education experts for sharing the ways in which culturally relevant pedagogy is embedded in the fabric of schools. Today's episode is only the beginning of a longer conversation that seeks to understand if culturally relevant pedagogy is the antidote to student engagement and academic success. As Dr. McCutcheon mentioned earlier, what we're currently doing for our Black and Brown students is simply not working. Current national data in literacy and numeracy indicate that public schools continue to experience problems with producing equal outcomes for all students. According to the 2015 National Assessment for Educational Progress, or NAEP, Black and Latino students continue to perform below their white counterparts. In reading, the average score for fourth grade Black students was 206, for Latinos 208, and for whites 232. In fourth grade math, Black students' average score was 224, Latino 230, as compared to 248 for white students. While Ladson Billings never intended for academic achievement to be solely represented by performance and standardized exams, nevertheless, we find ourselves in the predicament where school success is measured primarily by test scores. As educators, we will continue to wrestle with how to raise the achievement scores of historically marginalized students, while also incorporating relevant materials and practices that make curriculum more meaningful to students. And finally, we need to examine school-level and societal structures that contribute to the low achievement. These are the questions we will examine in future episodes of Pedagogy of the Obsessed. Thank you for tuning in. Adios.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through the restless and patient continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world, with the world, and with each other. The solution is not to integrate them into the structure of oppression, but to transform that structure so that they become beings for themselves. Liberation is a praxis of action and reflection on the world.